Welcome to the Better Call Saul edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the magic man to my tragic ham, it's Dan.
Tragic ham. Rum ham.
ham that hasn't been prepared very well.
That's me. It's pretty, and I guess a good morning to you since we managed to creep into the morning hours this time.
Yeah, I think it's almost a rejection of last week where we started abnormally early for us, you know, like a good hour and change before midnight. So now we're starting after midnight. So it's the After Midnight podcast recording once again. Speaking of post-midnight shenanigans, I believe we have a guest with us tonight, Dan.
Yes, for the first time we have the wiener to my ketchup, Jamie, joining us.
Wow.
Hey. Hi. I'm here. That's me.
It's a Battlestar Classic. Yeah.
I hope so, because I kind of hate everything about that analogy. I hate the idea of those of ketchup on something like that. I also don't like calling it that word. Welcome aboard, Jamie. You're the latest friend and listener to win the chance to be on our podcast.
Fantastic.
So yeah, Jamie, we know that you've been both a friend and listener for a while, and obviously you're a big fan of Better Call Saul as well. Hence, you wanting to join us this evening.
Yes.
Before we get to Better Call Saul, which will be about 60 seconds or so, I just want to give a congratulations and shout out to a couple of our favorite television series, which scored some nice gold at the Emmys earlier this week. In particular, The Americans, which has long been one of my favorite TV series for the last several years. I think it even came in number one at least one year that I was in one of our best of the year kind of things. But finally, Matthew Rhys has won Best Actor in a drama series. And I think the Emmys did the kind of thing they did with Kyle Chandler of Friday Night Videos when it was their last season, and John Hamm with Mad Men when it was its last season. So that's why I was pretty sure, despite whatever article I read going into the show, I was pretty sure Matthew was going to knock that one out. I kind of wish Kerry Russell had won as well. That would have been really great, especially since they're an actual couple. But it was kind of nice to see him win. And they also won for writing for the actual finale of the series, which was a great finale. So major congratulations for them.
Yay.
And also a show that we actually have podcasted about, and we have never podcasted about the second season, unfortunately. The Crown also racked in a couple. Specifically, Claire Foy won for Best Actress. And since she was my second choice in that category, I was kind of happy to see that happen as well. So just wanted to give a shout out.
I never finished the season. I only got, I was watching it pretty hardcore, and then I watched five episodes, and I just stopped. Sometimes it's just like too hard to load up Netflix. Of course, I was watching The Americans at the time, too. Right. So, that's how it goes.
I would encourage you to get back to it, because especially as you get later in season two, there are some really memorable, fantastic episodes there, and how they wrap that
nice.
Thing up. So,
agreed.
Yeah. Oh, you watch it? You've watched it? Okay, good.
I do.
The Kennedy episode. I mean, wow, that one's excellent, among others. Okay, so we'll get off the Emmys because that's not what we're here to talk about. And we will get started talking about this week's episode of Better Call Saul. Now, this week's episode was entitled Something Stupid. It was directed by Deborah Chow, who pretty much has a smorgasbord of one-time TV episode stints that she's done all over her IMDb page. I mean, this woman has directed everything from Mr. Robot to Copper to Jessica Jones, and literally it seems like dozens of other TV series. And based on the job she did with this episode, I do hope they bring her back for, you know, a couple more down the line. And it was written by an Allison Atlock, and some of her previous writing, she actually knocked out an episode of Stranger Things, but probably of greater interest to both myself and Dan, she wrote three episodes of Halt and Catch Fire, which is one of our personal favorite, you know, criminally overlooked TV series of the 21st century. So that's pretty cool to see that.
Right. Yeah, both of them were on the Insider podcast this week, and they seemed pretty cool. And both seemed to have the ability to, you know, do hardcore, awesome professional work. So they fit into the system they got there in Albuquerque really nicely and did a good job.
Awesome. So with this episode, I know we've been kind of, last few episodes, we've been chopping up into separating by character and storyline. And certainly we're kind of sort of going to be doing that again tonight. But it should be noted that the Kim and Jimmy side of things, or the Kimmy side of things, if you want to smash their names together like an idiot, that really dominated this episode. And considering the way the episode kicked off, I think, you know, we can touch on the Mike and Gus and Hector stuff a little bit later before we wrap things up. But I think we're really going to try to focus now on pretty much how we seem to be getting closer and closer to the unfortunate Kimmy split. See, that's a little take off on the... Never mind. Anyway, let me get to it. Yeah, it's two people in the audience probably got that joke. All right. So first off, the title of the episode, while it seems like it's taken from the song that accompanies the opening montage, Something Stupid, it's also a counter to an earlier episode, title of the season, which was Something Beautiful. You know, obviously one can say that things that Jimmy has done may very well be stupid, such as when Kim even says to him in this very episode, well, that was something. But I kind of like to think of it this way and give it a touch more of a tragic nature, I guess. Because when I think of, you know, earlier in the season calling something beautiful, that could also be seen as Jimmy's vision of the future that he thought he was going to be building both professionally and personally with Kim. Something Stupid, I think, is really the reality crashing that party. You know, the realization of maybe such thoughts were fantasy, and maybe now looking back on them, maybe they were stupid. So that's my 10-cent, you know, interpretation of the title here. But,
well, yeah, I'd say he, you know, sorry, I was eating some nuts. I'm eating nuts, so it took me a while to take care of the old mouth thing.
All right.
But, you know, I think, well, right now he might think of that as stupid. I still think it's, you know, I think it's totally justifiable that he would think that they would go back into, you know, doing business together. Because when they did it, I mean, they did it already once and it worked pretty well together. I mean, so, well, I think it's, you know, I think it was a valid reality for him. He just didn't quite notice that she wasn't really digging what's going on anymore.
Well, I think once we get to this episode, and specifically that amazing opening montage, one of the messages that's being sent here is this isn't going to happen. So let's talk about that montage. First of all, it's an opening. It's in my mind, it might be the most interesting, certainly the saddest montage I've seen on either this series or Breaking Bad, for that matter. I mean, right now in my mind, I'm kind of ranking it as, like, you know, in the top three sad montages that come to mind, you know, other than like the one from Up and the one from Futurama where that poor dog waits for Fry to come back for his entire life until he just dies on the curb, which is, once I saw that, it's like, that's the worst thing ever put on television ever. That's horrible. Anyway, but this was the time jump that I've been insisting and clamoring for, and I think most people thought had to happen at some point, you know, because we weren't going to have, you know, another season and a half of, you know, Jimmy waiting to get his license back, or, you know, or constructing this, the space lab.
The super lab?
The super lab, which actually is a much sillier phrase now that I think about it. With this montage and the time jump, they move forward several months, and we see time being ticked by holidays and different little and dates on PPD reports and so on. I mean, I think they knock off, I think it's something close to like 8 months or something in that neighborhood. with this
montage. Well, yeah, they definitely got from at least Mother's Day to January. I never watched it twice, but I know that those two things happen in there, and that would be 8 months, so I'm sure they've made it a little bit farther than that.
Right. Also, plus in an earlier episode, they mentioned that he was like 9 months and change away from getting his license back, and then at some point in this episode, we hear he's a few weeks away from getting his license back, or maybe a month, or something right. like that. So, you know, basic math made me go, okay, I guess it's 8 months, or something like that. So, I wanted to hear what you guys thought about this montage, because it's really, it's one of those things that on first glance, it's done so simply, but, so it's not, and they do a time jump. They didn't do any sort of, what do we call that, Dan, when you, it's not like they use time-lapse photography or anything like that, or which has been a hallmark of, you know, both shows, whatever. They kind of keep it, you know, playing in regular time. But they simply just employ a black dividing line, a split screen throughout the entire montage. Although sometimes that split screen is not a true split screen, because we see each of them cross the line early on in the montage. You know, whether it be him pouring her wine or her leg and foot, you know, kicking him in his sleep. I watched that a couple times, like, he doesn't react because he's sleeping, but it looks like she's kicking him in the crotch while they're sleeping. It's like that's kind of where that foot lands, but whatever. But like I said, the further it goes on, the sadder it seems to get, because it seems like there's more distance growing between them, figuratively more so than literally, perhaps. But when you get to the end of the whole thing, when they're in bed together, but the screen just goes dark on her side, it just seems that although maybe they haven't, you know, technically split apart just yet, but something about the closeness and intimacy that these two characters have really been showing, especially earlier on the season and late last season, seems to not be there quite as much. So,
right.
So, Jamie, what did you think about it?
It was kind of tough to watch, because I think anybody who ever has had a relationship where you either like lived with the other person or spent, you know, 90% of your time with that person, and that relationship doesn't work out for whatever reason, there's this thing that happens in your head where you start going through all of these moments of like, where did it go wrong? Where did it separate? And I think they did an awesome job kind of showing us what we go through our head in a relationship when it comes to an end, where you know you're starting to separate and you see all these little moments. And I have to say that the part at the end where Jimmy's sitting there and it's just him and the fish, mm-hmm. that's actually what got me the most, because that fish kind of represents like a future commitment between the two of them. You know, it's their pet.
Right.
It's just a fish, but here at the end, it's just this guy and the pet. It's no longer like a family unit. That's the part that bothered me, like even more than the black screen, because that was like the defining moment of what we were building together is now just a dude and a fish.
Right, right. Absolutely. I also like, I think it's around that same point in the montage when we see them at this point, then they're no longer eating together. They're eating separately at separate locations, and they're all, and it's all the way at the extremes, you know, at the extreme left or the extreme right of the screen. She's just showing physically just that much more space between them. It's in a weird way, it kind of reminded me of kind of reminded me a little bit of a famous sequence that's from the movie Citizen Kane, where with a number of cuts. We see how the character Kane and his wife, you know, originally they eat right next to each other or close to each other. And as the sequence goes on, we see that them becoming further and further apart. So at a certain point, they're at opposite ends of a very, very long table. In a way, they were kind of doing that here, where we saw them, you know, they're side by side. You know, they share the same space at times. And then by the time you get to the end, they're all the way at the extremes of either screen and in different, probably different times of day, different locations, whatever. I felt it was kind of like a play on that to a certain degree, I thought. dead.
Sure.
Any thoughts on this, Daniel?
Oh, yeah. Just, you know, the typical, you know, really, really well done montage by these guys. Longer than usual. So, I mean, you know that the work they had to do, I mean, just, I mean, basically doing, filming two different things for each one and then having it be super long. I mean, the work that they had to put in this thing was just crazy. I learned on the Insider podcast that the song that they actually commissioned it, mm-hmm. having it done, it wasn't like they paid an Israeli act to you know, make the song for the show, which is kind of cool.
Right.
But yeah, it was good. I mean, you know, it's probably the best montage the show has done. It's not as fun as my favorite one, the one with all the, you know, flopping air guys.
Right. And
I don't know what the hell those things are called, but that one with all the ties and the colors, I mean, it's just so much fun. And this one's a lot more somber and depressing, of course. But I dig the technical shit, and this stuff was rock solid.
Well,
I really need to watch it again a few more times.
Well, it's interesting because typically, whether it be this series or its predecessor, the montages do tend to have at least a certain fun quality about them. Whether it's the imagery chosen, the story that's being told, the music that's being used, whatever. This is one of the rare ones. I'm not going to say it's the only one because I'm sure then we'll think of another one or at some point. But this was the one that was just saturated in, you know, initially it's poignancy, and then it just becomes really sad by the end of it, because it's mirroring our own concerns and fears about what's going to happen with these two that we know to whatever extent is inevitable. And, you know, so there's that instinct where we don't want them to break apart. We don't want them to separate, but we know it's going to happen at some point.
Right.
So we've just been dreading when that was going to happen. And we've been watching, it was interesting how when the season started, that we probably saw, you know, like that first episode or two, the dynamic between them had been as close as we've ever seen it before. And we've seen them have, you know, more intimate moments than we had seen before. And from that point on, it's been crumbling. It's been chipped away, you know, when she did the big reveal to him at the restaurant in a previous episode. I mean, obviously that was a big dagger in things for Jimmy, who's still at that point has still not told her the truth about what he's actually been doing. Of course, we finally resolved that in this episode, and several months later, obviously. But
yeah, I definitely think that, you know, while the audience is really feeling that, like, oh, this relationship's going south, I thought the very last frame of this montage where her side fades out to complete darkness and he's just laying there, you know, the side profile, and you can just see the look on his face, and you can just tell, like, I mean, the acting there is just top notch, but just that look on his face is just like, you know, he can tell that things are, you know, things aren't going to last, you know, a heck of a lot much longer, and he can just, you know, he can just see it radiate right off him. It's just marvelous work.
Right. And because then we go from that to Jimmy showing, during the way it's shot, it's an unseen person. He's showing them around the space that he's planning, you know, for the new offices for his own law firm or whatever you want to call it, the practice, I should say, not a firm. I think anyone watching, we kind of knew from the get-go, just by the fact they weren't showing the person he's talking to, it's not going to be Kim he's talking to. It turned out to be Hugh, of all people. And even that, because, again, you start thinking back to previous seasons when they looked at different, you know, possible space. I mean, they did that all the way, I think they even did that all the way back in season one for one possible situation, and then the other one when they actually got that other space. But there was such a more level of hope with it, and you know, just pure happiness about it. This seemed a bit more of a sadness or desperation about it, you know, thinking that maybe if she sees this, it would, you know, make her come around. But at this point, if she's heading, you know, heading up the banking division at the big law firm and really has ingratiated herself there over several months, there is there isn't any indication, at least from the montage, that she would consider change, you know, switching and going back to, you know, having a practice with him. It's just not the feeling that we're getting. It's not the vibe we're getting from her at this point, I think.
I do kind of wish we had seen some kind of a short scene where she told, Mesa Verde, you know, Paige or, you know, dude, mm-hmm. or whatever, that she was going to do whatever, just to see, because I just kind of curious to see how they would have reacted mm-hmm. to that. I'm thinking that, you know, it was just going to be her running the thing, and then all of a sudden she's kind of morphed into a larger law firm. It's not something necessary, but I think that there was enough, you know, enough groundwork laid there where I think it would have been a scene I wouldn't have minded seeing.
Yeah, that ran through my head too. It's been clear that they wanted just her, all of her attention on them, and I kind of find it odd that they haven't included that conversation. Yeah.
I'm sure she sold it well, you know, with the huge expansion, it would have made sense that she wouldn't be able to handle all the workload on her own, and I'm sure she was able to, you know, convince him that fine. I just kind of wish we would have saw it.
I guess
it wouldn't have worked in this episode, of course. It would have had to happen before this, so there really isn't a place for it. If this is going to start with montage, there never would have been a place for it. I just kind of wish...
That's my feeling. It's one of those things where I could see them having given that some thought to do a scene like that at some earlier stage. But just based on the timing of these episodes and everything, that's something that it even conceivably probably wasn't. It's one of those things I can imagine hearing, this was shot, but then we realized there wasn't a place for it just in the previous episode or here.
Sure.
And they kind of resolve that by, you know, one of the running recurring images throughout the montage is that she keeps putting up these different little trophies symbolizing each of the different branches opened up for Mesa Verde. Notice that they focus on the last one, which is located in Nebraska. I thought that was kind of interesting that they kind of focus a little bit on that one, because I keep thinking, Nebraska, that's where he ends up. I wonder. We're going to see an older Kim in that, going into a Cinnabon or at some point or something like that. I'm still going to go with the idea that they're not actually going to kill her. You know, I'm just thinking they're just going to separate, because killing her would just be horrible. So I can't imagine they'd do that. Watch they do that. But hopefully they won't do that.
So I kind of have an impression that if we do see her at some point in the future, that she won't have, you know, seemed to have aged as much in comparison. Like, I get the feeling they might do something just to show that, like, you know, whatever she did was definitely the right decision, and she's just, like, happy and not all, like, you know. I mean, you know, Jean's in disguise, so that's a big difference. But, I mean, just I think that if you see the two of them in a scene together, even if she doesn't recognize him, I think it'd be a really interesting contrast to show her just being all, you know, radiant and just, you know, barely looking any different, and him just looking like, sucks to be me. Get me some more cream cheese frosting. Damn it.
So... The next major thing with the two of them is Jimmy joins her for a party at the law firm. And we get that, and of course Jimmy's his usual sociable self at first, the way he's interacting with everybody, like he's everybody's best friend, whatever. But he goes to check out her office. And I think that was the thing that kind of, like, you know, kind of put him over for the rest of that, his time at the party. As well as probably loading up on the liquor even more so at that point, because
This is wondering why he was measuring it off exactly. If it was just some kind of like a, you know, seriously, this thing is huge, measuring it off, or was there anything more to it than that?
I assumed he was comparing it to the offices that he had been looking at with Huell earlier, and just trying to
make sense.
You know, that was my first take on it.
That's smart.
But there's that part where he's looking at that little framed letter from, you know, a grateful client of hers, you know, thanking her for believing in her and all that kind of stuff. And you see his face, like, reflected in the glass and how he's looking at it. I think that was the part that probably bothered him even more than, you know, the splendor of the offices and so on and so forth. Because, you know, it's kind of showing, like, this is what she really wants to be doing, and how she's accomplishing it, even while she's at this firm, whatever. So it's kind of like,
do you guys think there's any kind of like a confused judgment in their thing too? Like, cause I got the impression when he was a public defender, he really didn't have like any emotional connection with anybody. So do you think there's also some kind of like a, you know, he just doesn't get why she's having a connection to these people that he just, you know, treated as a, you know, 75 bucks here, 75 bucks there crap.
Yeah. And he's, he's really never taken his job seriously. You know, he does, but it's like he's always trying to win a game. And there's not a lot of feeling behind it outside of winning that competition. It's the thing that he's always searched for is validation. And he was constantly doing that with his brother. And he's never getting this validation. And he sees her doing the same job that he was doing. And, like, she's getting handwritten letters. Like, she's getting this validation. And I think that probably, like, way in the back of his head probably bothers him.
Yeah.
I think.
No, everything you guys have said is true. I mean, we've known from the get-go, but more so especially with that flashback in a previous episode, that, you know, the law was not his calling the way it was to either his brother or to Kim.
Right.
So, and that's in a way, that's kind of problematic when you're going into a profession like the law if you're going to be a lawyer, if you're going to be a doctor, or you're going to be an actor, those are the kind of things that you have to really put your heart and soul into. It's something you have to really, you know, it's not something you kind of just do on a whim. Although a lot of actors always say they weren't going to be an actor, then they went to an acting class and all of a sudden they fell in love with it. But still, that's how it happens. I don't think Jimmy ever fell in love with the law, you know, the way I think both Kim and Chuck did. So, and you're right. Whatever empathy or sympathy or whatever you want to call it, we've ever seen him, either it be as Saul or even Jimmy have in regards to his clients, you know, it always felt like it's kind of a put on. And the only time we've gotten him feeling, I think we've seen him feel genuine emotion, is more based out of guilt, like when he feels he's done something wrong, like the stuff with the elderly people, with the senior citizens, mm-hmm. when he realized he went too far and he's caused something which, you know, he still has a conscience, at least at this stage, and he tries to rectify it even to his own, you know, discredit.
Yeah, I'm wondering at this point if, like, you know, if Jimmy McGill is really, a little bit more of a sociopath than we ever would have, gave it some thought. Because if you really think about it, I mean, there isn't a lot of stuff that he gives a lot of, you know, has a lot of feeling about that isn't, well, for one thing, just, you know, him specific. And if you really think about some of this stuff, I mean, he might have regret about burning his relationship with all the, the elder law clients. But, you know, but I don't know if he was more upset about betraying their trust or more upset about, like, okay, this, you know, this avenue of revenue is now closed to me and I'm not going to get, you know, validation or whatever he's looking for in that.
I would be apprehensive about using a word like sociopath for him. Not a full one, but
leaning in that tendency. Direction more.
Some tendency.
Not Dexter.
Yeah, I would say more. Sometimes he does lack a conscience at times, or he might not be the most empathetic person at times. But at the same time, there are times he does. You know, even in this episode, you know, he is going, you know, to the wall for Huell. You know, and it's not simply because he's the guy helping him with the cell phones. He does there does seem to be a certain, he does seem to actually generally care about what might happen to this guy. But it's also, I think it's a tendency we have with some of these characters, specifically the leads in a lot of our favorite shows over the years have that about them, where there are times or maybe even a consistency with the characters that they might not care about others quite as much or in the way that they should. And maybe they care more. Maybe it's a sense of narcissism with them. It's more about themselves.
Yeah.
I would sooner say he has more narcissistic qualities and sociopathic qualities. The only reason I wouldn't say sociopathic because I've always felt that he genuinely loves Kim. I mean, that's what kind of drove him to like even become a lawyer in the first place. I think he always had a quote unquote thing for her, and it finally manifested in something beyond friendship. Only more recently. But yeah, because we could say this, I mean, to varying degrees, of course, but we could say that kind of thing about whether it be Walter White or Don Draper or, you know, a number of others, and obviously the better written characters.
And the more narcissistic thing too. I mean, maybe instead of like just not understanding like emotions, maybe he just doesn't understand like emotions that aren't like totally tied to his own self-interest, which, you know, of course, is more narcissism than anything.
Right. That I think makes a heck of a lot more sense. I think that's more spot on with him, because he will care about others, but it's also exactly, it's tied to his own self-interest, his own self, whether self-interest, self-worth, whatever, whether it be his brother or, you know, a client or Kim or what have you. But, you know, we knew going into the series that to whatever extent we're going to be dealing with a main character who is damaged in some sort of way. We didn't know the background of Saul Goodman before, so we just thought of him as just being this slickster, huckster type of a guy, which is fun to watch. And quite frankly, he did have people seem to always forget this, which really kind of frustrates me when they just kind of label Saul Goodman one way and don't look at him in any other way. It's like, Saul Goodman did have moments of genuine humanity on Breaking Bad. Not a lot of them, but we do remember a few of them, specifically the stuff with Jesse and that girlfriend of his and all that kind of thing. Which is kind of one of the more poignant parts of Breaking Bad, quite frankly. So, where were we? Oh, the party. Oh. So when Jimmy comes out and he gets involved in that conversation about the possible places the law firm might go on their next retreat. I love the buildup of it. I love how at first he's going right along and he's making a suggestion which kind of make, you know, oh, that's kind of cool, kind of makes sense. And then he keeps upping the ante to something more and more, you know, ridiculously lavish and expensive. And you're watching, it's one of those great things when you start, he's oblivious to however people are reacting. Now, we can say that's because he's been drinking, or because he just doesn't care, or he's just so wrapped up in what he's saying, he's not even acknowledging it. But between Kim's face and Schweigert, oh my God, Schweigert, who looks increasingly more uncomfortable as it goes on. And I love that. And I love the more and more he's talking, you see more people are overhearing and they're coming over to listen. And like, once he goes to Aspen, I was like, okay.
it's pretty awesome seeing him. Like, he literally looked more uncomfortable when Jimmy was talking about them going to Telluride and Aspen than like when Chuck and Jimmy were just like owning them in the sandcastle case.
Right.
So,
sandcastle. It would have been cool if it was called sandcastle.
Sandcastle. I loved that
company doing fixing for
sandpiper.
I love that scene though, because, well, besides the fact that it was hilarious watching everyone's face, it was just Jimmy being Jimmy. And when you go back to the, you know, the opening montage, it kind of fits in with that. It's like the things that make you initially attracted to somebody, like their charisma or their sense of humor, whatever it is, eventually can turn into the exact reasons why you try to distance yourself from that person.
Right.
And Jimmy's just being Jimmy and doing his thing, his sales pitch. And like, you can see it click in her head where she's like, I don't like this part of you right now. And so it's great because it's hilarious to watch, but it's also like really sad because there's one of those moments.
It continues the sadness, so that when they're in the car, if this had been X number of months earlier, they would have an argument. She would address this and they would get into a thing about it. At this point, it's basically, that was something. Yep, and he just puts on the radio or whatever, and that doesn't even faze her. It's like, that's it. She doesn't talk about it any more than that, as far as we see. And to me, that almost put the exclamation point on the whole thing. It's like, yeah, if someone was just watching this for the first time, or they've been watching the show all along, your first thought is likely to be, I'm watching the dissolution of a relationship here. And it's just, you know, and again, since we kind of love these two together, it just makes it that much sadder to watch. And I'm echoing things that have been said by a lot of people, be it, you know, viewers or other writers, whatever. There is something really bizarre about the series, in a great way, but in a sad way. We went into a show called Better Call Saul because we really enjoyed the Saul Goodman character, and we got a big kick out of him. Oh, we're going to do a series with him. Oh, it'll be fascinating. And as the show went on, we realized, I'm okay with not seeing Saul Goodman for a good long time, because I'm really enjoying this Jimmy McGill character, because yes, he does you know, cut corners or do things which aren't really on the up and up here and there, but it's kind of like he's always been doing the wrong thing for the right reasons, kind of a character. And now it's like, the more the Saul Goodman stuff is starting to seep into the show more and more, it's like, can we put it off for like another season? Because, you know, we know we're not going to get to 2008, so we can wait. But now it's, and I can't say they sped it up, because they haven't. You know, we're more than midway through the fourth season, and he hasn't gone full Saul yet. But good Lord, is he close. You know, it's really, I mean, especially when we get to what we're going to talk about next, with the whole stuff with him selling the burner phones and his encounter with the cop. And the fact he's going under the name at this point, which they show, I guess they showed it in the montage, the business cards. He's now using the name Saul Goodman, because that's the identity he's going to use for selling the phones, which is going to be interesting. That's going to be the persona he's eventually going to use, period. I'm kind of curious how they're going to do that. I am looking forward to. I just want to see how they explain that. Does he actually have his name legally changed, or he just assumes an identity? Because I got to figure out how they're going to work that whole thing out. But
I'm pretty sick of him now. I mean, after that scene, I mean, Schweiker was being super cool, wanted to take everybody skiing up at Taos. And, of course, you guys know Taos is the area where they film Longmire. So for Jimmy to do anything to fuck that up, I mean, he's the villain of the show now. Team Longmire, come on.
You and your Longmire. Just hang out with my mom. She's a big fan of the show, apparently. So we get that whole scene with the cop. And the entire exchange between them, I mean, again, obviously this is the kind of conversation, the flow of it and the way he speaks to the cop. Yeah, that's not much different than the way Jimmy might necessarily speak. But it felt really Saul Goodman-y to me, you know, the way he was because that was one of the things we did see a number of times on Breaking Bad was Saul Goodman dealing with the authorities and kind of just being very defiant with them. And now we see him doing that here. Unfortunately, Huell, wearing his headphones, can't hear Jimmy trying to tell him to not do anything. He's a cop. And I guess we find out that when he hits him with a bag of sandwiches. I guess they're very heavy sandwiches. Well, if it's Huell eating, maybe. So we find out that the cop has encountered Babineau before. He actually arrested him a few years ago for pickpocketing. So he's totally going to press charges against him. Nothing Jimmy can tell him will make him think otherwise, because he wasn't going to do the cop a favor, you know, just a few minutes ago. And so the cop has no inclination to help him out. So I think it's around this point, shortly thereafter, when we see Jimmy in a suit with Huell. That's when we first hear him mention, I can't remember if he actually says a month or a few weeks, whichever it is, it's one or the other, before he gets his license back, which is also kind of narrows down how long that time jump was. But he mentions, you know, even if he's not a lawyer now, he's a magic man. which turns out it means he's going to go to Kim for help. Now, everything we've just said about Jimmy and Kim, from the montage and the party scene, whatever, I felt 1,000 times more in the entire scene with Jimmy going to see her at the law office. Because it underscored everything that we've just talked about, I felt. Because there's definitely a huge distance between them at this point, and the way they talk to each other. I mean, it kind of made me oddly uncomfortable, if that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. It was really uncomfortable.
And it's also, it's kind of like what, Jamie, what you were saying, I think it's what you were saying before about the way Jimmy was speaking at the party. And like her realizations of like, I don't like this. I thought this was kind of cute and charming once upon a time, and now this is exactly what I would not have wanted you to do here. This is, and you know, you're a grown man. You're not a kid. There's no excuse for this kind of behavior at this point. The way she reacts to the different things, you know, while she's talking to him, like him mentioning like, he's been selling the burner phones all this time, or his idea to basically, you know, shred the cop's reputation in order to save, you know, Huel or whatever. And then she says, I'm not going to tear down a cop, whatever. Right there, it's like, there are such fundamental differences between them. If there was any question of whether they would start a practice again together, I thought this kind of essentially, like, there's no way they would start to have a practice together because they see things so differently. And even if that was always the case, I think it's just become more, we're seeing it become that much more clear to her now.
So yeah. And she looked so mad. Like, she looked so mad at him for a minute. I thought she was going to start yelling, but then, you know, she jumped into her Kim role of like, okay, how am I going to help Jim? You know, how am I going to help Jimmy out? But she, like, there for a minute, she looked like she was going to throw something, which I probably would have done had I been in that situation. So it's interesting, like, she's breaking away, but there's still, like, a lot of codependency happening in that relationship.
It's interesting, because that's one way to look at it, and it might even be the right way to look at it. I kind of went the other direction, and it's kind of like what I said about them in the car. The fact that she doesn't makes me think that she's past this already. That she's already gotten to a point where it's not as big as this relationship is not what it was to her, you know, several months ago.
Sure.
And for the rest of their scenes together, we see other things that happen. I don't need to skip ahead, but I'm going to anyway. You know. Because even later on, when she's talking to him about just following her lead, just you go along with this because it's the only thing that can be done at this point. And the way he's responding to her, and the way they're going back and forth, to me, I think it's really clear that she doesn't trust him. She doesn't trust that he'll do what needs to be done here. He doesn't trust.
Yeah.
She doesn't trust that he's going to do the right thing. He's more likely to do the Jimmy thing, or, you know, and not the good Jimmy thing for that matter. And so that was, again, also something that it's between the lines, but it made that scene a little bit uncomfortable as well, because, like, God, we've spent 3.5 seasons of, you know, the building and blossoming, or whatever you want to call it, of this relationship, and now it's just. It doesn't feel like it's there. And it feels like these two people they're still involved with each other, but they probably shouldn't be. And I think, you know, it's kind of like you were saying about people in relationships. We've all had that, but most of us have had that where, you know, it's before the breakup actually happens. It's very rare that a breakup happens and you don't see it coming. You know, maybe you might be on the end where you don't want to see it coming, or maybe you don't want to deal with it. But, you know, you know that there's those days or weeks, or in someone's case, years. But, you know, But you know what I mean. I don't mean you, Dan. You know what I was talking about.
But I mean, even when you think you don't see it coming, and you have a little space from it, and then you like look back, you see that montage run, and you go, "Oh, how did I not see that coming?"
Oh yeah, it's all fucking there, right there. Yep.
Right.
So
well, you know, of course, you know, now we're at this really weird part too, where like me, I'm kind of like, you know, I still think Kim is awesome and pretty great, and I'm losing more and more respect for Jimmy as time passes. So I kind of like, you know, want the relationship to end because I think she deserves better. So, you know, things have kind of shifted for me a little bit where it's still sad that it's going to crap because he's just disappointing and not able to, like, you know, not be him.
Right.
Yeah, but, I mean, you're watching your best friends break up and you're going, which side am I going to have to pick?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly like that. And it gets that much worse for her when, after she sees Jimmy in the office, she goes to talk to the prosecuting attorney. And when the prosecuting attorney refers to that Hugh is working for a a scumbag disbarred lawyer who peddles phones to criminals, and you see the look on Kim's face. I mean, putting aside the fact he wasn't disbarred, he's only suspended, but that doesn't matter. I thought that this hearing someone else's perspective on Jimmy, which, I mean, she's heard negative things about Jimmy over the years from, you know, from like Chuck and Howard or whatever, but nothing quite that brutally nasty. And quite frankly, to a certain extent, true. I mean, whether we want to call him a scumbag or not, it depends on your perspective. I wouldn't go that far. But everything else, I mean, that is kind of what he is. And it's like, how, because quite frankly, if this is what he's doing, how can she be with him? Because that's gonna end up staining her as well. I don't know. I don't see how she could possibly keep dealing with that.
And one thing in Jimmy's defense, if when he's acting like this, you know, selling phones to criminals and stuff like that, he's just being himself. So to be fair, I mean, you know, should he have to change? You know, we hate to see people that we care about try to change themselves because it never fucking works when you change yourself for a relationship. So, mm-hmm. You know.
Right.
Well, I'm disappointed in him, and I don't think he should be lying to her and stuff like that. I mean, there is an element of just, I mean, you know, that too, where, you know, I feel, you know, a little bad for somebody who tries to change themselves for somebody else and fails because it just doesn't.
Not who they are.
But I think from Kim's perspective, what she had viewed Jimmy as before, I mean, she knew that she knows about his con man past, but a lot of that was just taking advantage of people who, you know, had the money to spare, who usually, you know, maybe in some ways even deserved it to a certain extent. That's why she even went along with him, you know, for during that week of frivolity way back when. But there's a difference between doing that, you know, conning the guy with the coin or this, that, or the other thing, you know, to get money out of them. Or to reiterate what the prosecutor said, you're peddling burner phones to criminals, which, and she knows full well that means it's drug dealers. And it's like what the cops is like, you don't feel any remorse about that. Like, you know, I don't, you know, like, it's not my business what people do with them after I sell them to them, even though you know that's exactly what you're doing. I mean, you're selling out of a van, you know, off by this, you know, by this highway thing. That's not a place where reputable people go to buy phones, you know? It's not like you set up a stand in a mall or something. So it's the fact that you know full well that he's doing something which is, you know, number one, aiding criminal enterprises. B, criminal enterprises that aren't anything that you can really rationalize as being a good thing or, you know, have some sort of positive quality. It's for drug dealers. So I feel that also kind of just became one more, you know, black mark against him in her eyes. And the fact that when, she, again, going back to when, after that, when she's talking to him about following her play, he's deliberately not saying yes to her. He's hedging the way he's responding to it, which is making it even worse. Which is making it the fact that she doesn't really trust him. You know, what's the word I'm looking for? Justified. Because he doesn't say, oh, okay, absolutely, I'll follow your play. You know, like, he even uses the word, like, legitimately or something like, in some context, which is like, okay, you're basically telling her you're going to be, like you were saying, you're going to be Jimmy. You're going to do the Jimmy thing and do your own thing here, which is exactly what she does not want him to do. So yeah, and we see that preying on her mind when she drives off, and then I guess she all of a sudden she turns around and pulls into like some, you know, I don't know, like a Staples or something. I don't know. She starts you know, filling up her shopping cart with like tons of like art supplies. It looks like it's for like a grade school class because like, you know, it's paint. It's probably glitter in there. I don't fucking know, construction thing, whatever. And when she calls him, then I guess that's how the episode actually ends. That she says that she has a better way. So, it's kind of an odd little cliffhanger to end the episode on, I guess. You know, when I talk about something with gigantic stakes to it, you know, other than whether Huel goes to prison for a couple, for like two years or not or something. But I am very curious of what her plan would be.
Yeah, I found the cliffhanger to be surprisingly riveting. I mean, I think it's safe to assume that Huel probably doesn't go to prison over this, because if he did go to prison over, you know, why would he work with Saul again after getting out? I mean, it doesn't seem like, you know, if he ended up going away and some stupid thing working with this, you know, small time guy, why would he work with him again? So right. I'm just assuming that he'll get off and she's just gonna, you know, do something with freaking crayons or something. But for whatever reason, I'm just like, I mean, I was at the edge of my seat, and then, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing whatever the heck she's gonna do. I mean, the one thing too, it's, you know, it's a smart character that we like, so I just want to see what kind of like creative, you know, plans can have to be. But I have no idea what the hell that she's gonna do, and I'm just looking forward to it a lot.
Okay.
Do you think she's gonna come up with something like seriously legitimate, or do you think she's like pulling some cues from Jimmy? I kind of have a vibe that there might be some shenanigans to make this work.
I kind of feel that there'll be shenanigans, but there'll be shenanigans that would still be within the confines of the law. That she's not.
Yeah, because she has a pretty strong moral compass.
Exactly, which he doesn't. Because it's just like the things that she had done before. You know, like what they did with Chuck, whatever. Although she felt bad about it, it still fell within that realm. You know, the only thing she felt bad, the thing that was bothering her, is the fact that she knew very well that Jimmy did, you know, screw around with those documents, and it put her in a bad position because, you know, she couldn't really, you know, shred Jimmy on it, even though Jimmy ended up paying the price for it anyway. But I don't think she would do anything that would be. She wouldn't be too Jimmy here, but there's something. I wasn't trying to say that I didn't like the cliffhanger. In fact, I'm impressed that they can make me put me on the edge of my seat about something which is not a quote unquote life or death kind of a thing, so to speak. Which was what we get used to with some of these shows. Gosh, there was something I wanted to say. Oh, I also like I left this out. It just popped into my head. Another moment, they just put the exclamation, again, I'll use that phrase again, put the exclamation point, the period on it, whatever. When Jimmy's basically, you know, leaves her office and she has her assistant, like, just close the door in his face. That one little moment there, which we've seen kind of like little versions of that kind of Jimmy in a doorway kind of thing throughout the season, but just having that door closed to him, just to get into, you know, symbology, whatever. It's like, it's kind of a, you know, that this door is kind of closed off to you. This person, this life is kind of closed off to you, I think. If you want to take it to that extreme, which I just did, so who cares? did you guys?
Interesting. Very, very interesting.
Oh, shut up. Anyway. Was there anything else either of you wanted to pop in here about the Kimmy and Jimmy? Kimmy and Jimmy. Jimmy, you know what I'm saying. it's late, and I'm only recently sober. Come on. Anyway.
In Kim's office, she has a painting of Navajo Mountain. It's like a large mountain that's important to the Navajo people in Arizona. It's not like super tall, but it has a lot of like relief and compared to the rest of the area around it. So you can see it from like all four states, and you can see it from really far away in, you know, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. So I just thought it was kind of cool seeing. I mean, it's the kind of painting that you would see in that kind of setting anyway, but I just kind of thought it was cool that it's a mountain that I can see like all over the place when I'm down there, and it's neat.
Hmm.
Yep.
Unless Jamie has something to say,
I have nothing to add to that. Very, very great job at noticing that, Dan. You are the master of all mountains.
Speaking of mountains, oh my God, I can't believe you gave me such a nice segue here. If we shift over to Mike and the Germans, we get a little sequence. It's not really a montage exactly. But it's, you know, them working on the super lab under the lounge or whatever. And the tune that's playing throughout the whole sequence is Big Rock Candy Mountain. This is a version sung by Burl Ives, which is actually...
Big Rock Candy Mountain is a mountain south of Interstate 70 in Utah, near between Salina and Maryville. I don't think it really connects to this song, and I actually looked it up, but there is a mountain, a really weird-looking mountain called Big Rock Candy Mountain there.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm assuming there's no cops with wooden legs and bulldogs with rubber teeth on that mountain. I am going to assume it's a different mountain entirely. Unless a lot of hobos hang out at that mountain, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe they do.
Based on the level of opiates flowing through that area, I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. The Mike stuff, I don't really think there's that much to it this episode. Basically, you know, the Germans are getting a little stir crazy. There is an accident where they knock over one of the one of the columns, whatever, which means they're gonna have to rebuild part of it again, whatever. And apparently that Kai guy is still a problem. And Jimmy even floats the idea to the guy in charge of maybe we can just send Kai back to Germany. Now, of course, I keep thinking that's code for, you know, we're just going to get rid of Kai. But it turns out he's like their one main demolition guy, so they kind of need him. And again, the guy keeps saying, but they're good boys. They're good boys. Like, they're not good boys. They're assholes.
But, yeah, and I kind of didn't think that Kai was really out of line in the situation. I mean, they've been working hard, they're all wore out, and then this Joker backs into a thing and, you know, fuck us up with their work. I totally didn't see anything wrong with Kai getting pissed off there.
I agree. Know? I mean, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, Kai might have been a big ass in the previous episode, but he was totally...
Yeah.
I thought, like, they all should have reacted that way. I mean, I would have been pissed off.
Yeah, I'm sure he's been a cockass for, you know, the last several months too. But I still think Mike kind of overreacted.
Now, did question for you guys? Did you see like when Mike was having the conversation with, I think his name is Warner, about Kai? Like, did you see any similarities to a few conversations that Mike will have in the future with Walt about Jesse?
Oh yeah, I definitely
like. I see a lot of familiar. That. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely can see that. Because it's one of those things that sometimes we forget because, you know, the later stuff will sometimes holds in one's memory more, but his attitude towards Jesse in the beginning is very very similar because he's. I wouldn't call him a loose. He'd say like loose cannon, but he's not something you can trust because because he has a drug issue, whatever. So that makes him, you know, fallible. It makes him, you know, possible, you know, weak link kind of a thing.
And there's a lot, you know, a lot of his concerns that he will have with Jesse could be because Jesse is exactly what you just described, but I also wonder if Mike isn't looking back to this and what we're going to see happen with Kai. Like if it doesn't trigger a memory for him or a warning of, you know, this happened in the past, and now I'm seeing this kid, and you know what I mean? Like, there's some connection to that in Mike's head.
Interesting. Yeah. Makes it interesting because then it makes me want to rewatch Breaking Bad, and eventually I will, and watching how the Mike and Jesse relationship certainly evolves over time, and how he viewed him, maybe he viewed him as a Kai kind of guy early on, and at a certain point, he's almost like a surrogate son to him, because
right.
You know, so it's kind of how that evolution happens, even with Jesse's, you know, rather serious problems that we, you know, his drugging and his weird drug party stuff, which I was like, it's really weird. I don't know if there's really much else there as far specifically to Mike. I remember in an earlier scene in the episode, I was thinking, oh, it would be kind of cool if Mike's actually learned German. But then we figure out later on he's just learning like certain phrases. So one wonders when that guy is insulting him if Mike knows what he's saying. I'm sure he suspects that he's knocking, regardless of what did he say his name is? Bert? Who cares? We're going to say his name is Werner, even if it's not, because I just, you know, it's just kind of funny. I think he knows full well he just got insulted by the guy. You know, I can't, because Mike's not an idiot. You know.
Yeah, I think he's just listening for his name.
Yes. So that leaves the stuff with Gus and Hector and that doctor. So again, since we've bounced ahead 8 months or so, when we see Hector in the hospital, this is a heck of a lot closer to the Hector we've been used to seeing on Breaking Bad. The only thing missing is the bell and the actual wheelchair at this point. But, and he's clearly already in that ornery, disagreeable, you know, Hector mode, whatever. But he also apparently still has a bit of a libido. And while he's kind of, you know, not really paying much attention to the doctor, trying to get him to identify different things on charts and see what his response time is, he's more interested in checking out the nurse's ass, to the point where he even knocks over a cup so that she'll bend over so he can take a look. Can't really see how the doctor wasn't really aware of this. It's kind of happening right there, but whatever.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe she'll end up voting for Trump and won't care if like a dirty old demented man is just a complete hornball.
All right, so
it's just boys being boys. Just yeah. Boys being boys.
Oh, no, I feel guilty, and I don't even know why. So then later we
ding ding.
Yeah, we have. So later we have a scene at Gus's house. Which, so Dan, is that the same meal that he was preparing for Walt? I feel like I can't remember
if he was making clams then or not. I don't know. I could be totally wrong,
but I feel like the meal he was making for Walt had something to do with eggplant.
Hmm.
Yeah, it does sound. I think it was more of like some kind of a, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I've watched so much like Bobby Flay doing stuff. Chopped. I don't know like who's cooking what anymore.
Okay. Well, I think this was like paella marina or something like that. I don't know, which meant it was like a seafood. I mean, obviously, I think it was clams. It might have been other things in there as well. It might have been one of those things that I like jambalaya. I can't pronounce it. I'm not even going to try.
Jambalaya.
Thank you.
Captain Sisko makes a good jambalaya, so I'll never forget the pronunciation of that.
There you go. And now we've got it. Look, it took so long to get a Star Trek Deep Space Nine reference in this podcast.
Well, we got the long wire in a while ago, but yep. Oh,
God. So, getting back to the scene, talking to the doctor about Hector's progress, yada, yada, yada. The important thing is she puts on the video to show him Hector's progress. And Gus picks up on what's going on. He winds it, whatever. And there's that look on his face, which I thought was fucking great. And it's at this point we find out something that I don't think we knew, that we didn't know before. Maybe we suspected it might end up happening, but now we know for a fact. if he keeps the Doctor on, Hector's progress is going to continue. And she is very confident that he'll even be able to walk again. I don't know if she mentions anything about him, if she mentions anything about him being able to talk again as well, but I know she mentioned the walking thing. But Gus feels like she's done enough. She should go back, to the hospital. He's helped set up that wing for the kids, blah, 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 whatever. Because he doesn't want Hector to progress any more than this. He wants him to remain a prisoner in his own body the way he is right now. So the way we see Hector, the condition that he's in, Gus is totally connected to that now. To a degree more so than we might have realized. Because he might have... Again, Gus is the guy who brought in the Doctor to help him in the first place, but still, it's the satisfaction of, yeah, but I'm not going to let him get to a point where he actually feels truly like a man again. And the fact that he sees him do that and checking out the woman, whatever, all the better that he's going to remain, confined to a wheelchair, unable to walk or do anything. Because kind of sort of means he probably won't be able to do anything of that much of that nature either. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm going to go with it because I think that's just... It's just a lovely bit of insidiousness here. I that was a moment that I really liked with Gus. I actually liked that look on his face and what he ended up doing. I felt that was more whoa than his little soliloquy about the kalate and the fruit tree, whatever, in the previous episode. I thought this was a lot more, ooh, there you go.
Yeah. So. Yeah, totally.
What do you think, Jamie?
I can't disagree. It was one of my favorite scenes, actually, getting to see Gus be the Gus we know, with not very many words, just facial expressions. And I mean, he's always awesome. It's just that's how he is. But the look on his face when he recognized what Hector had done, that was good. That was goosebumps.
Yeah. It's funny. It's something I feel. We watch a lot of great TV series over the years. I think we end up talking more about facial reactions or face acting, as Brian had said in the previous week, and I think I said the week before or whatever. That really seems to be a hallmark of this show. I mean, everything from the montage, because obviously there's no dialogue throughout all that. So we're just looking at the way people look or they're expressing themselves. Mike is all about face acting here. But Gus, it's interesting because he's always so very stoic. Mm-hmm. And purposely almost expressionless, whatever. And seeing that moment and that it's almost like a slight smirk. And I don't even remember if I've even seen Gus do that before. I've seen him do the fake smile thing when he's in, the Chicken Man Gus Fring mode, which doesn't really count because he's playing a part. But I've never seen him like that before. And if he has been like that, again, I'm just forgetting it. And like you said, it kind of gave me kind of like, ooh, that's really, it's like deliciously evil, much like that food, I'm sure was.
And you can totally understand why he's happy too, because I mean this Nacho kind of like took his planned at some point revenge out of his hands, but like this is a moment where he realizes he can be the one that keeps Hector in this condition himself, so he's able to he has enough I guess he's in control of the situation again, and he knows it, and he just that must be quite the relief as well as satisfying
in its own way. I mean, although at first it seemed like what Nacho did disrupted whatever his master plan might have been at the time, it's taken time, obviously, because, again, all these months have passed, whatever. But now we're in a place where, this couldn't have worked out better for him. Because, yeah. He said with that story, he's like, it's not about killing Hector, it's about making him suffer. And if he just can keep him in this condition where he's basically permanently incapacitated and basically just has to live out his days as an immobile husk, whatever, you can't really do much better than that. By the way, we haven't seen Nacho in a while, for a few episodes now, so I'm kind of wondering if he's gonna, hopefully he'll pop up in the next episode, because it's been at least two episodes in a row we haven't seen him. Two or three, I can't remember now. And he was saying, please, playing such a big part this season, it's kind of weird that we just haven't seen him. And now that all this time has passed by, I'm really curious to see what Nacho is up to. You know, where he is in, you know, either it's Gus's organization or what's going on with him. So I'm hoping we get some Nacho, or Nachos. So I'm kind of hungry in the next episode.
I really love his character, but I'll be honest, I'm dreading for when we see him again because I'm so worried about his dad that every time we see him, I'm like, oh God, no, please don't do anything to his dad, because you know what, it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say without the Salamanca's situation, maybe. Because we don't really know, because of the time jump, we don't know what's going on with that at this point. So I'm very curious about that. We know where it was when we left off, but I'm really curious about that. Like, are we going to see, are the cousins going to show up again or not? We know they went, you know, quote unquote, they went back to Mexico. So I wouldn't say they went into hiding, but just to take themselves out of the game after they wiped out the Espinosa crew or whatever they were. But I'm wondering if we're going to see them again or... And quite frankly, I still think we might end up seeing Stephen Bauer's character, the Don, show up again on the show. I'm kind of waiting for that to happen at some point. I'm kind of thinking it will happen.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see him again. I don't think we've seen him for, what was it, last season? Season before?
Yeah, I can't even remember now.
Been a while.
But I'm feeling like we're going to see him again. So last time I saw him, I saw him on this, and I also saw the actor on a very weird episode of Sneaky Pete. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing him again. And that's kind of sort of it. I think that kind of wraps up that's pretty much the entire episode. So the only other thing I would want to add was, I know at the end of our previous podcast, we had a rather lengthy discussion/debate between me, Dan, and Brian about how we felt about the show/the season so far. And while we were all positive about the show and the season, I was letting a few criticisms kind of seep into my view of the show. I just wanted to say that this episode really restored, not that I was losing faith in the show, but this, for me, really felt like it got back on track as far as where, having a better view of where the show is going and where the characters were going. And again, it might have been simply solved by a time jump. That maybe it's like I thought it might. I don't know, but that's what I'm feeling here. But all I'm going to say is, like, this really, for me, got the show rolling again. And this was one of my favorite episodes of the season. I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's definitely one of my favorites of the season.
Yeah. Well, since I refused to allow Brian on the show, we can't ask him about that this week. But Jamie, you weren't a huge fan of last week's episode, were you? Are you more on track now after this sweetness?
Well, I'll tell you, I rewatched it because a certain somebody kept telling me I needed to rewatch it. I liked it more the second time around. But still, there were some key points to it that I really liked. But this episode put me right back into where I kind of wanted to go. So I'm with Scott on this. I think it's this episode pulled things around in the direction I kind of wanted it to move.
Yep, and also I was right and you liked the episode more. That's really what's important here. So we'll just talk about that.
And also being aware of the fact that now that we're only a few weeks away from, you know, Jimmy getting his license back, that means we're getting closer to him being, you know, a lawyer again, which is kind of what I feel the show's kind of missing. We were getting like a little taste of that here by the way he was talking about certain things or interacting with other lawyers, whatever. I just kind of want to see him in that mode again, and then finally figure out how does he end up practicing under an assumed name and stuff. I don't necessarily know if we're going to get to that this season. That might be next season, but I'm definitely very curious about it.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right. So with all that said, I guess I'll do the quick little rapidy up thing here. If y'all out there enjoyed this podcast, chances are you'll enjoy our hanging on our Facebook page as well. It's a Serious TV Drama podcast page. You can like the page and join in conversations about Better Call Saul, as well as any other TV show or anything else you feel like talking about there, within reason. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our feed, as well as rate and review us. Just type in Serious TV Drama. That should be enough to find us. You can Google us as well. We're available everywhere. Not that anyone finds us that way anyway, but I've done it. And finally, you can follow our little used Twitter feed. Our Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast. STVD as in Serious TV Drama. We should be back next week to cover the next episode. I actually, for the first time, I actually peeked ahead of what all the titles for the rest of the episodes were this season. There's a title of one episode coming up. It's like, oh, I bet I know what that one's about. The word is, you know, when there's an episode, I think episode 9 is called Avida Jane. I can't pronounce anything. God damn it. Someone pronounce it for me.
Avida Jane?
Thank you. So I got a funny feeling what might happen in that episode. Yeah. That also might resolve might solve the question of, hey, how many Germans get killed off or not? So I'm thinking if there's an episode with that title.
Maybe for all we know, Schweigert and Coakley could take the crew on some kind of a skiing trip to Switzerland or something. I mean, there could be some kind of screw ask and let's go all the way.
That sounds like the best episode I'm never going to watch. So, like I said, we will be back next week for the next episode of Better Call Saul. I don't know. We haven't really talked about what we're going to be doing moving forward post Better Call Saul. We'll figure stuff out at some point in the future. Either I don't know what we're doing as far as the superhero stuff, or if there's another show coming on that I'm forgetting about that we might want to do, or some Netflix stuff. I'm quite frankly, I'm shocked we've never decided to do a full blown, you know, two part Ozark podcast at this point. I could see us doing it. And if someone
ever still haven't started season 2, I prefer to save the finest things in life as long as I can, delaying the gratification. I know Ozark will never disappoint me.
I still can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not when you talk about Ozark to this day, because you spent so long saying that before you'd ever watched it, because you were just in like mocking mode, and now you've watched it and you speak the same way. It's like, I don't know, I can't tell if he's making a joke or not. I kind of like that I don't know, so never clue me in. But if we do a podcast,
we'll leave the mystery be.
If we.
It's an amazing show, and he knows it.
I watched the first 3 episodes of season 2, and I just got busy with 18 other things, and I didn't get back to it. I actually did put it on earlier this evening, and then I was like 10 minutes into episode 4, and then I watched it for like another 20 minutes, and I was like, oh no, baseball game on. Okay, I'll get back to this later, and I haven't gotten back to it yet. So I might finish it. I might finish that episode tonight. Before I go to sleep.
Get to it.
I got to Walter White my head first and shower, so can't do that just yet. Alrighty then. Okay, well, Jamie, thanks so much for joining us. You were a breath of fresh air on a rather typically rancid, stuffy podcast, so thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. Well, good times.
That's all. Well, Danny's been insisting on having me here for a while, so. I was like, no, I don't want her on. I'm just kidding.
Not until I beat her in Words with Friends.
Oh, don't. Are you about to perpetuate a lie on our podcast?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, God, she just played Gauntlet for 37 points right there.
I believe I still maintain the winning edge in that, because there's no one who's beaten me. no one has an edge on me in Words with Friends. That's why no one plays me anymore. Okay, anyway, Wow, weird thing to brag about at the end of a podcast. Tell us more. You're the best at tying your shoes. Anyway, that's it. Where are we? Okay, I want to finish the sucker up here. All right, so anyway, thanks for joining us. And I'll start the round of goodnights with goodnight, Jamie. Goodnight, Dan. Goodnight, everybody out there.
Goodnight, guys.
Night.